Okay, after a little bit of a hiatus, and we took a little bit of a vote here. So the conclusion was that we will try to conclude talking about heteriska. So we previously had done two parts on Rivus. First part is a general introduction to Rivus, and we talked about some of the theories as to the Tamei HaMitzvos of Rivus, which was very important overall for us to get into the concept of heteriska. And then part two, we introduced what heteriska was about. And that was basically to kind of understand how the heteriska worked. And I think that that was really all we did about it, if I remember correctly, although it's been a few weeks. But I think that that's basically as far as we got, really just to kind of understand how the heteriska works, the general structure of the heteriska. And we didn't get much beyond that, if that's correct. I'll just try to recap the basics so that we have a framework from which to continue now. So we gave a few theories as to what the Issa Rivus was about, and they were to address the mysteries of Rivus, the fact that it seems to be more of a Yoredeya kind of thing than a Choshen Mishpat kind of thing, and the fact that it's not just about exploiting a borrower in need, but it applies to even reasonable rates of interest, and that most pointedly, that it applies even to the borrower who is also in violation of an Avera and has no authority to be Mochel. And that it applies specifically only to Jews. So we gave a few theories, and the important part is that the theories all had a common element that the assumption is we're dealing with chesed loans. And that the Torah wants us to provide chesed loans without any ulterior motive and without any collection of compensation. And we gave various ways of saying that. Maybe the idea is that it's an offense against the Kadosh Baruch Hu to say that we're only going to do this chesed if we are guaranteed a return, even if it's a very reasonable return. And we compared that to Shemitah and saying you're only going to do Shemitah with a guarantee. That was one level of explanation, and that's maybe to see it as kind of a bin adam l'makom. We saw it as maybe an enhanced bin adam l'chavero, in that it could be reasonable to charge interest of a decent rate, but you wouldn't do that to your brother, and that the idea is that you're supposed to see the whole Jewish people as a family. And we also suggested that maybe it's to preserve your objectiveness when you are giving out loans of assistance. It's like tzedakah. It's part of the whole concept of tzedakah. And if you were able to have people pay for the privilege of getting the loans, so then that would be somewhat like a bribe. And that could explain certain details, the fact that it applies even just to nice treatment, which doesn't have to cost the borrower anything. So it's not about exploiting him, but it's more about how he treats the lender. And that maybe does put it in the category of a bribe, and that's an interesting possibility. And that certainly could explain why the borrower is part of the offense and why he can't be mochel. And then we also gave the possibility that maybe it actually is exactly what it looks like. It's about exploiting someone in need, but it applies even to reasonable rates because low plug, how are we going to know where to draw the line? And also we can't even let the borrower be mochel because then everyone's going to feel they have to be mochel. But the basic point being that all of these share in common that it is about chesed, and that's what allows us the room to talk about a heteriska, because a heteriska, we're assuming, only applies for business loans. That when somebody needs capital for business, so then we can start talking about providing that with some kind of a return, because we are assuming, whether we're correct or not, but we are assuming that this does not contradict the spirit of the law. And that's what allows the space for this to exist. And we also added the Tara Tamima's point that there's been a major shift in how the economy works. Once upon a time, somebody who borrowed money did so because he actually needed it to live, and the person who lended money wasn't taking on any opportunity cost. Nowadays, both of those may not be true. Somebody could borrow money because he just wants to profit, and the person who's giving that money is undertaking a opportunity cost. So both of those could be significant differences. And we also mentioned the point raised by the Sefer Beit Matzis Yohu that in general, if you're giving somebody a loan because they're in need, so then if you're going to ask them to pay for that more, so then you're pushing them further into need. But if they're going to use that loan to make money, so then it could be reasonable to say, okay, you're profiting, so let me share in the profit. There's no harm in that, even though letter of the law, it still violates the Torah. So letter of the law, we have to find a way to address that. But against spirit of the law, maybe we're on decent ground. So then we talked about the structure of the heter iskah, and I think that was our whole second part, talking about how we basically restructure the arrangement so that it is a investment, that the one providing the funds is giving it to the recipient as an investment, a part loan, part investment, so that he returns the loan interest-free, and the rest he uses to grow for himself and to grow for the provider, and he gives the provider that extra as a return on his investment. And the tricky part is it's basically a guaranteed return. It is a rate that is set in advance, and we discussed how that could be done. That's where things do get a little dicey, because that's what seems to distinguish a loan from an investment. A loan, other than the risk of default, basically is guaranteed, while a investment should have risk. So how exactly that's brought about? So we talked about the hoops that the recipient would have to go through in order to prove that he fell short at all of the projections, and how that was devised. And we also then, I believe, discussed the fact that given all that we've said, the assumption really is that this should be used only for business opportunities, even though there were some poskim, specifically in earlier generations, who thought there was some basis to allow it even for general loans, because everything is fungible. So if you can't pay your rent, then you can't make money either. So we could treat everything as somehow connected to your ability to make money. But more recently, poskim such as Ramosha and others were more machmir on it and felt that really it should only be used for profit-generating enterprises, and that's for reasons both of the spirit of the law and even the letter of the law, that it's even questionable if it would even work from the letter of the law perspective if you're not dealing with something that would make a profit, and that certainly would have problems on the spirit of the law level. And we talked about the Chafetz Chaim, that it wouldn't be a fulfillment of Chesed, and his various objections as well. So I think that's most of what we spoke about. So to take it a little bit further, so there are some other points to make. So we also noted in between, when we took our hiatus before Shavuos and talked about something else, so a point that can be relevant here, kind of to segue from that. So before Shavuos, we talked about the Pintel Yid. We talked about ramifications of Matan Torah and the assumption that the impact of Matan Torah on the Jewish neshama, that we all accepted the Torah and showed our desire to accept the Torah, that maybe that was the basis for the Rambam's ruling in Hilchos Gerushin, that you can compel a get and consider that to be willing because deep down every Jew wants to do the right thing. So that was invoked in the context of Heter Iskah also by the Chalkas Yaakov and before him by Rabbi Yoel Kalatzkin to address the question of what happens if you have two parties involved in a heter iskah and one party or the other doesn't understand it or maybe isn't even interested in it, which is easy enough to imagine, right? You could have one party who is observant and one party who isn't. Let's say it might be more likely that the borrower is observant and concerned about halacha and the lender isn't, and the lender doesn't really care about the heter iskah, but the borrower does. So what happens in that situation? So there is a big discussion about two aspects here, about one, the aspect of understanding, and the aspect of actually being committed to its details. So just to address a part of it, so it's various parts of it. So first of all, the question of whether a heteriska has to be in writing. So many assumed that heteriska, and this will come back to another context also, could theoretically be effective orally. You could just declare that you are dealing with a heteriska. But there is a shita of the Tzemach Tzedek that many make reference to, that's based on a Ritva in Ksubis, that he insisted that, this is the Tzemach Tzedek of Lubavitch, that insisted that a heteriska has to be in writing. And this is because of a Ritva, that Ritva in Ksubas talks about a woman who's mochel on part of her Ksuba. And the Ritva writes that we're worried that here this may not be a serious mechila if it's just verbal. That even though you could do such things verbally, but it may look like a harama, it may look like it's a fake if it's not actually written down, which would give it more seriousness. So at least l'chadchila, we're concerned here that given that the heteriska is something which is susceptible to being perceived as a harama, so therefore he thought at least l'chadchila, it's something that we should insist on writing, on having it written down. So that's one aspect of the seriousness and the commitment that is addressed, and that whether or not that detail of writing it down is accepted, it says something about the idea that there should be aspects of seriousness that are conveyed. And Reb Moshe and his Shuvas, so he thought understanding was very important because he emphasized that the heteriska is not a magic formula, that it doesn't just automatically make ribbons disappear and that any kind of connection to how the parties relate to it, that it specifically is about a understanding, and without that understanding, it's not going to work. We mentioned before that if it's not going to be a profit-generating enterprise, Reb Moshe was machmir on that, because he said it's not going to work then in concept. But even if it could work, theoretically, but you should also appreciate that it's not a magical formula, and that it requires actual understanding. The Shla thought that without understanding, it would be kechucha chlula, it would just be like a mockery. And if it wasn't sincere, then that would be a harama. I think we've talked about it in the past, that the concern of harama that we find in some things, so when we talk about mechiras chametz and the like, and certainly an issue that comes up in the context of the heteriska, so harama sometimes means that it's a evasion, and sometimes it's a focus on whether there's sincerity or not. So here we see that's what the Shla is picking up on here. He says that if you don't do it sincerely, so then it's harama, and he thought then they would still have a full issa ribbis, that if it's done without sincerity. And he thinks that's why the Torah talks about v'yareisa melukecha in the context of ribbis, because this is something where motives make a difference, and it's possible for one to work around the details and do so insincerely, and that's why Yiras Shamayim is particularly relevant here. But there were those who thought that the Rambam and Gerushin could be relevant here. And as we noted, Michal Kisyakov in his Truvis, he makes reference to Rabbi Eliyahu Kalatskin. And I was always trying to find this Truva Rabbi Eliyahu Kalatskin. I was actually zochet to finally find it serendipitously just a few weeks ago. I was in Bigelizen and I saw that they just came out with a new printing of the writings of Rabbi Eliyahu Kalatskin. It was a fascinating Polish Rav who died in 1932. And his writings, he wrote many svarim, but they're very hard to find anything. And you can find on HebrewBooks.org, you can find his svarim, but they don't even, forget about Mefteches, they don't even have tables of contents. So it's very hard to find anything. So the fancy new edition doesn't, of course, have a index, but it actually has a table of contents. So in the Sefer Evan Pina of Leo Kalatskin, now we can find this essay where he does indeed talk about this, that he says the default is that because of the Rambam and Hilchos Gerushin, people want to do the right thing. Maybe that's connected to Matan Torah that we celebrated on Shavuos. So therefore, if there is a mutter way to do things, so we can assume that they're intending to do that, that they're going along with that. So if you have the heter iska in use, so then even if the parties don't really know what's going on and they're not really misyachis to it, well, we don't have to worry about that, and we can assume that the heter iska is valid. Now, it's interesting because even if you want to use the Rambam and Hilchus Gerushin, so that's still a leap. Because, you know, there, the Rambam is talking about a case where there's a chiv to give a get. So he's saying, okay, so there's a mitzvah to do. So we should assume that everyone wants to do the mitzvah. But here, there isn't necessarily any obligation to be lending the money ribis. So why should we bring in the Rambam and assume that the Pintel Yid is active? So here, the idea is that once you're getting into this situation, so then the assumption is that you're doing things the best way within the context of what you're doing. So once you're doing it this way, so then the assumption is you're doing it the proper fashion, and that's going to be enough, and that the intent of the Torah supplants any other possible intentions that may be there, which is a pretty fascinating idea. Shlomo Kluger, in his Tshuvas, he wrote that a lack of understanding on the part of the recipient is okay, is acceptable, as long as if a court is asked to enforce the arrangement, it's not going to be collecting based on interest, but rather on the iska arrangement. In general, so there's a preference that both parties should be sincere and knowledgeable about the iska, but there's still many grounds to be makel after the fact. However, in the Sefer Bris Yehuda, the classic, contemporary classic Sefer on Ribbis, that was written by the author of the Pesach Choshen, Yaakov Shai Bloy, he writes that there's something that's worse than ignorance. He says that if you have one party who's knowledgeable and the other party who's not, and the less knowledgeable party asks the knowledgeable one what the heter iska is, and the other one says, it doesn't matter, it's just something we gotta sign, but it doesn't mean anything. So he says, that's a real problem. He says, so that basically means that the heter is going to be ineffective, because you're basically saying that it's ineffective. This is something that Rav Binyamin Cohen notes in his Sefer on Ribbis, Chalkus Binyamin. And that response is basically a claim that it's meaningless and that it's really being carried out as a interest-bearing loan, and that he thought was worse than simple not knowing what's going on. That's an important point to consider. So there was a fascinating historical discussion here about a heter iska klali. So the heter iska klali exists, or was discussed at least, on a couple of levels. So nowadays, so you find in banks and in businesses like that, so there is the use of a heter iska klali, which means that if you have interactions and transactions which are happening all the time, which could involve concerns of ribbis, so then there is a declaration that's put in a public place that everything is happening with the understanding of heter iska. This is something that's mentioned in the Tshuvas of the Maharsham, who says that this is something that should be publicized all around, and everyone should know that this is the nature of these transactions. And there's a fascinating tshuva about this in the Maharash Engel. And even though there were those who didn't accept the viability of this, there were others who did, but the Maharash Engel went so far as to say that the rabbinate has an obligation to promote such devices to make sure that people will be saved from ribbis, and he thought that failing to do so is a dereliction of the chiyuv to minimize the isurim of the public. And if you look at his tshuva, I thought this was particularly fascinating, that you see that he's not just saying that derech hadrush, because he brings halachic makoros to consider whether there really is a Isser involved in terms of Lifnei Iver and things like that, that the rabbinate has a chiyuv to make sure that this was carried out properly and that there was a minimizing of Isurim, and failing to do so is a dereliction of responsibility. It brings halachic source to that effect. So that's a particularly fascinating idea. So that is in use to some extent. There's some controversy about it still, but that is widely in use, and many understand that that's particularly understandable, acceptable, because in the context of these transactions, so everyone knows there are a lot of rules and regulations, and this is a part of it, or this could be a part of it, and that's acceptable. But there was a fascinating discussion just about 100 years ago, almost 100 years ago, in 1924. So there was a Polish rabbinic journal called Druschen, published by the Agudas Arabanim of Poland, and Rabbi Israel Eger, who was a grandson of Rabbi Leibel Eger, so meaning he was a great-great-grandson of Rabbi Kiva Eger. So he was concerned about how people in general were unaware of the Surim of Rabbis. And he says maybe it's not people's fault, they aren't educated, and they have all kinds of tirdas of parnasa, and they're distracted, but lamaisa, people are transacting in ribis, and they are being nichshol in all kinds of isurim. So he thought that everybody should write a personal heteriska klali. Once in their lifetime, they should, as they begin their career in business, they should make a declaration that all of their transactions should be understood as in that framework of heter iska. And he noted, yes, that's not ideal. And anyone who is aware and knowledgeable and remembers, you certainly should use a specific heter iska for your transactions. But this is still worthwhile in case you forget, or in case you otherwise would fail to make one. And there's an interesting lumdus there. He says that whether this works, so this depends on how you understand the functionality of the heter iska. Says that if a heter iska is basically a kinyan, so then it's hard to say that you can apply it to the future. To say that it could work for a kinyan on something that isn't yet ba'olam, that's difficult. But if you want to say that it's basically a tanai on an interaction, so a tanai you could make in advance. And he says you have many such tanaim in halacha that are specifically there in case you may forget at the moment. And he makes reference to our Rambam and Gerushin that we mentioned before, that he thinks is relevant here. Here it's a little bit more pointedly relevant because he thinks that you don't have to go as far as Julio Kolaskin did there. He says that basically this is something that a Jew does at a moment when he's stronger, when he remembers, in case he may forget later. So that fits the Rambam even better. We're saying that when the Yetzer Hara is dragging you down, so then we go back to your inner Ratzon, and that defines what you really want to do. So here you take the moment when you do remember to declare what you really want, and then if it should be that you should forget, so then this is going to be the determining desire. So there were many endorsements and there were many detractors. Some were printed in that issue, some were printed later. He published the Sefer a few years later called Takanas Rabim, where he published many of the endorsements. And just to mention some of the svaras that were said back and forth, some of the Rabbanim were very well known, some were a little bit less well known, but just to mention what some of the arguments were, so there was a Rav Yitzchak Rappaport, who also addressed the Lumdus, and he thought it depended how exactly the Iska worked. We mentioned last time that there were different models of the Heter Iska, so Rav Yitzchak Rappaport wrote that in the original Heter Iska model that was based on what was described in the Gemara, so that's based on a partnership, and that there's a shared ownership of some kind of a business venture. So that, he thought, requires a genuine kind of kinyan. And that's going to require two parties making a kinyan together. But the later model of the Maharam Avigdor's, That is based on the recipient working on behalf of the funder, which basically happens through shlichus. And shlichus, that can be arranged in advance and even unilaterally with a shliach not yet determined. So that model, he thought that davka could work. So in the original proposal, so there was support from some prominent rabbanim, including the same we mentioned before, Rabbi Eliel Kalatzkin, who thought that this was a good idea too, maybe not so surprisingly, and he brought some additional arayas why he thought it should be good, and also Rav Meir Arik, so he also supported it, but he modified it a little bit. He thought that instead of doing this once in your lifetime, you should do it once a year. And that he thought that a good time to do it would be the Aseres Tumei Tshuva between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. And then in the journal, when they published this, so he said, they wrote that this is something which is very dachuf and very relevant for the rabbin. So everyone should come and write, say whether they support this or whether they're against this, and everyone should weigh in. So then the following issue, they had more people writing in. So there were more supporters, the Marash Engel, who we mentioned before. He was the one who was saying that the banks should have this and that the Rabbanim who don't support that are neglectful. So he supported this as well. He mentioned that in that Shuvah also. It was a Rav Chaim Yehuda Ginsburg who said that the person has to take a Shvuah that he's not going to go back on it, then maybe he would support it. Rav Avram Yaakov Horowitz thought that it's theoretically a good idea, but he was worried that people may become then kind of lax in terms of using specific iskas, which everyone acknowledges is better, so he thought the Rabbanim have to be careful to speak about this and remind everybody to do that. But then there were others who were more concerned. There was Rabbi Yaakov Meizels, who was concerned that people would forget about Ribbis in general if they were able to just set this up. And this we see reflecting a part of the whole Harama concern that he apparently is not worried about the Heter Iska itself that we've been talking about the whole time, that isn't going to make you forget about Ribbis. But this just lifetime Heter Iska Kali, that would make you forget about Ribbis. While the ones who were supporting this, so you see how they looked at the whole thing, so they were saying that already Ribbis is being forgotten, and this is better than that, because instead of having Ribbis be totally forgotten, so this will address it at least on a minimal level. And if you accept those who said, like Rav Meir Arik, that they should renew it every year, so at least then there's some awareness. So there's something going on that's better. So, you know, this is similar, for example, to Prizbul. I don't remember if we discussed Prizbul, but there were many who felt that Prizbul was Omaila because that was the way of engaging with Shemitah Kesafim, as opposed to just ignoring it completely. So you have to know what the alternatives are. There was Rav Meir Avowitz, who wrote in this journal that he was worried about how you would enforce this whole plan. And you could say this is a good idea, but who's necessarily going to make sure people are doing it? So he thought the only way this would be viable is if you had communal enactments, and you would instruct everybody to make sure to do this. And he said that would also itself be valuable, because then you would help to protect the consciousness of Ribbis. And there's also a letter from Rabbi Yehuda Leib Fine, who offered his own suggestions, where he was also talking about the role of communal leadership. He said maybe everyone who comes to Sol Chametz before Pesach should sign this declaration. Or, we thought a better idea is that every year at Kol Nidre, on Yom Kippur night, so then they should make an announcement that all the transactions people do are within this understanding, and anyone who protests, they should speak up. And then by doing that, so then you have this endorsed by the Rabbanim, and the people are agreeing, and then that will be a binding enactment. And then that'll be even better than the actual Heter Iska, which he says that is normally a harama, but this will now be a genuine Iska, and that'll be even better. So among the objections that were published in this second volume, there were two very prominent detractors who were to become very well known, Rav Aaron Cutler and his father-in-law, Rav Zalman Meltzer. So Rav Aaron Cutler was opposed, and he brought various riyas why he thought it was a bad idea, both in terms of its idea and the details. But mainly what he was concerned about is that it's unilateral. And he said, in order to have a heter iska, so you need to have the two people agreeing together. Now, the suggestion was assuming that if everyone did this, so then it's basically bilateral because all the parties are going to be involved. But that's also a part of the whole question here, is whether you can have a unilateral iska at all. But this is what it seems to be, that if you're just telling everyone by themselves to do this, that it's unilateral. And so that was a part of his objection, which was also in the Tshuva's Chavetz Hasharon. He has a tshuva which he wrote in response specifically to Israel Eger, and he raises that objection also. He's worried about a unilateral heter iska. And he's also worried that this will do more harm than good, because it'll lead to people just completely forgetting about the notion of an individual iska. And this is Zalman Meltzer. So he was against the whole thing, because he thought, this was different than we said before from the Tzemach Tzedek, he thought that all you need for a heter iska is just a verbal declaration. So he said, if that's the case, so why is a person not just doing that? So it must be that he's afraid to even remind the lender of the concept, thinking that he's not going to get the loan then. And maybe that's the problem here. So the editor of the journal, he said, no, that's not what's going on, that this is specifically for Yirei Shamayim. And no one ever was claiming that this should be effective against the will of a lender who wouldn't do it. And it's not what we're talking about. But this whole issue of bilateralism, whether both parties are agreeing or not, so this was one of the major points that both the supporters and the detractors were engaging. And that was a major part of the back and forth. And the supporters thought that if everybody was doing it, so then that would be enough to make sure it was bilateral. If Aaron Cutler thought that wasn't enough, how are you going to make sure that that's happening? And others thought that that's a good reason to make sure you should do it every year instead of once in a lifetime. So this was argued back and forth, and there were a lot of opinions. And then, like I mentioned before, eventually the Sefer Tachanis Rabbim was printed a few years later. So in the Sefer Bris Yehuda that we mentioned, the Bloy Sefer on Ribbis, so his assessment of the whole discussion was that he thought that the majority of Rabbanim who discussed this, he thought they agreed with the premise. But he doesn't think that they actually acted on it in Poland when this was happening there. This whole debate was happening in Poland. He thought the majority of the Rabbanim agreed, but they didn't actually take it up. Later on, in England, the Poskim in England, the Menchas Yitzchak and the Cheshev Haifod, Chanuch Padua, so they considered this issue, and they both were a little skeptical. Rav Padua, the Cheshev Haifod, he thought that if you have two people who are always doing business with each other, that they could make a standing heter iska that will reflect their continuing relationship, but otherwise he was a little skeptical. Rav Shila Raphael, who was a great dayan, who passed away a number of years ago in Eretz Yisrael, so he thought that this really was a good idea, and it's a chaval that it hasn't taken off, and that it should be revisited, that it should be taken up again, because maybe this could solve a lot of problems. But in any event, it doesn't seem like it has taken off, at least on the personal level. But in terms of banks, so we do find that there is still some debate about the heter iska quality in banks also, but it's more widely accepted. And that's probably for the reasons that we've said before, that it's more specific to the transactions, and people expect that there are rules and regulations surrounding those transactions, and that that's more generally understood. So the acceptance overall of the heter iska of any type has to do with the factors that we mentioned, the idea that it's understood to be more in keeping with the spirit of the law, and also that there's an assumption that there's a need for it. The Chelkes Yaakov in his Tshuvas, where he has a lot, as we've seen, to say about Heter Iska, so he suggests, he understands that all of Klal Yisrael and their participation in the economy is going to really depend on the ability to provide capital, and without that you're going to fall apart, and it's a great tzarech. And he says that if Chazal were mekel for agunos, so kal vachomer we have to allow this, because agunos are only a small portion of the population, and this is all of Klal Yisrael, so it has to be allowed. So this is a fascinating kind of attitude. The need is a big part of it, but I think also a big part of it is the whole spirit of the law consideration and the assumption that this doesn't violate the spirit of the law. And that being the case, so we can focus on that strongly and also make sure that that's the case. Again, we use this really only in conjunction with loans that aren't about chesed, but are about business capital, and make sure to keep chesed loans about chesed, but also to be sensitive to the issue that the Chafetz Chaim was raising, that the possibility of getting a return on loans, even when it's purely for business purposes, shouldn't mean that you're disincentivized to lend any money for chesed, because if you think that all of your available funds will now be used only towards, or could be used for profit-generating enterprises, you might then say, okay, so I'll do it all for that. I'm not going to use anything for chesed. I'm not going to necessarily try to get profit off of the people in need, but I won't deal with them at all. So that will also be a problem. That will also be a big chaval. So that's also something to worry about. So it's important to keep that in mind. And we should also acknowledge that there were some who understood things differently. We should take a look at the commentary of Rav Shamshon Nafal Hirsch in Parshas Behar, where he seems to understand that the spirit of the law does apply even to business capital. And you could take a look just to acknowledge that he has a different understanding. And I should note, I've heard a few times Baal Peh from Rav Asher Weiss Shlita that he seems to understand differently, and he understands that the Heter Iska basically is ribbis that the rabbis have permitted. So that seems to take a harsher view as far as the spirit of the law. So just to formulate that within the spirit of the law, so presumably that's focusing on a different component and an attitude that we also see in Chazal, that we always find a concern, shlo tinol dalis b'fnei lovin, that we want to make sure that the, as much as we don't want to exploit the poor and have them have to pay to get a loan, but worse than that is that they shouldn't be able to get a loan in the first place. And that relates to Chafetz Chaim's concern that, okay, so maybe you won't exploit them, but you'll divert all of your available money to business endeavors, and that's not going to be good either. So that's also something to worry about. So if the only options were that don't lend to the poor at all, or find a way to be able to charge them interest, so chaval, that could be evocative of the whole conundrum of Kripal, and that's his own discussion. We'll talk about it at a different time, but Rav Lichtenstein has written very lamentably about how Kripal came about, because the way he understands it, that seems to be the choice that Hillel was confronting, either find a way to allow loans to be collected after Kripal, or there would be no loans. So it's a very dreary way of seeing things, but maybe that's at a minimum what's going on here, that it was a choice of either find a way for interest to be collected, the heter, or there wouldn't be any loans in the first place. So certainly, at a minimum, we want to make sure that there are loans being provided to those in need. That is the basic imperative. So if it takes finding some path in order to protect that, so it means we're at a very low level, but still, that's the emphasis. But hopefully it's more than that. Hopefully we are providing loans for those in need interest-free completely in all senses of the word, and hopefully that continues to happen at a high level and is there at all times when needed, and that Klal Yisrael is able to participate in the economy in a way that's appropriate, both in terms of the spirit of the law and the letter of the law, and that the Hazir Iskah really is only used in that context and under those circumstances. Okay, so we will stop there. We'll wish everyone a wonderful night and a wonderful Shabbos. And God willing, next week we'll talk about something else. All right, have a great night.